This is the sixth chapter of the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, and this may be the most famous and most quoted chapter, and certainly considered by many among the most useful. As it is Martin Luther King Day tomorrow, I thought it would be fun and interesting to work with some of his famous thoughts on loving your enemies and why nonviolence is the path to really make change in the world. And instead of giving some of the normal Tibetan examples for some of the verses, I'm going to read from some of his writings. And I was particularly looking at Nonviolence, the Only Road to Freedom, and the other speech called Loving Your Enemies. So we have been using the short bodhicitta prayer as a framework for the organization of Shantideva's texts, an easy way to think about generating bodhicitta. And I'll read that again. Bodhicitta, the excellent and precious mind, where it is unborn, may it arise. Where it is born, may it not decline, but ever increase higher and higher. And in the earlier chapters, we've established that bodhicitta, or the open, wise, loving heart, is really our goal. And even when we contemplate that, it is the beingness of that open, kind, loving heart, which would be realizing the nature of your mind, or becoming a Buddha in training, which would be a bodhisattva, or becoming a Buddha. And at each stage, you have increased wisdom and skill and increased skillful means to benefit beings. So that is the goal. The earlier chapters, where it is unborn, may it arise. And then this is the final chapter that covers where it is born, may it not decline. So as you're opening your heart and developing loving kindness, how do you prevent that seed from shriveling up due to drought? Mostly, I always introduce my teachings by saying I'm not a highly realized lama, that you can think of me as essentially your older sister who is learning with you and has devoted some time and study. But for this chapter, I can say it's the one I'm really well qualified to teach, because it's how to work with your strong emotions. So not only have I studied it formally, but I have used it a lot. I was fortunate to study with Geshe Sonam Rinchen in India for several weeks, and with Pema Chodron on this chapter for several weeks. And I can also say it really has saved my sanity at some times. It is very important and very useful understanding. As we're working with this chapter, some of the verses you may find surprising or counterintuitive or even shocking, because he is reframing how we think about things. How we think about our wounds, how we think about what has happened in our life and our responses to what's happened in our life. So I want you to start with me today with the perspective that we're looking at how to heal our anger, how to heal our minds. So that is the context. We're not trying to change something that happened to us or look at a future event. We're trying to heal our minds so that we can be conscious of every action and every response in the future. And we are healing our anger because we understand that it's harmful for us. The Dalai Lama has been talking in his big public lectures recently about a wise selfishness. Okay, if we acknowledge that we're all self-absorbed, selfish to a degree, let's be wisely selfish. So we can see that when we are angry, when we are caught in anger, we are troubled. And as I was saying before, sometimes the translation for the strong emotions are we are tortured. So we know that our wounds torture us. We know that our habit of reacting to situations actually disturbs our mental peace for days, months, years. So we can say that we do understand that our own anger tortures us. Shantideva counters heated emotion with a reframing of our perceptions and an application of logic. How can we apply logic to this situation that we think of only emotionally? And our friend, our coach, Shantideva, even works with teasing kind of humor at times. So you'll hear his teasing voice come through as well. So as we're starting, because it can be a little difficult to absorb some of these things, I'm going to suggest that rather than trying to imagine a situation where this verse could not be true, that you, when you're thinking about the verses, instead of a hypothetical situation, think about something in your life that you have experienced and how can this help it, right? So a lot of times we want to imagine a situation where you could not love your enemy, where it would be too difficult, where no one could possibly do that. That's not the purpose of this text. The purpose of the text is to heal our anger. So use the reframing on a personal situation. The other thing that is stressed in the Dalai Lama's book and by Martin Luther King is that patience is not meekness or resigning oneself to victimhood. So it's not in any way about that. It's not idiot compassion or fear masquerading as caretaking. It's not unquestioned acceptance of suffering. So if we are in a dangerous situation, if you, others, or the perpetrator is being harmed by their actions, or if the actions have negative long-term consequences, if you have the skillful means to act, it's important to act. You're actually breaking a bodhisattva vow if you don't act and you did have the skill. If you don't have the skill, then you want to remove yourself and others from that situation. Okay, so it's not in any way putting oneself in a situation that they're unable to handle and becoming a victim. So the traditional Tibetan definition, patience is, I like the definition of healing anger. That's the title of the Dalai Lama's book on this particular chapter. But it's also tolerance and forbearance. There are a number of qualities. It's not patience in a simple sense. It's a whole range of qualities that we don't have one word to encapsulate. A good definition is a resolute response against adversity stemming from a settled temperament, unperturbed by either internal or external disturbances. A resolute response against adversity stemming from a settled temperament, equanimity, not acting from hatred and internal circumstance and not reacting to violence and external circumstance. A consciously adopted stand not to retaliate against an actual or perceived harm. So it's the consciously adopted stand that's important. So comparing this to Martin Luther King, nonviolence is an absolute commitment to the way of love. So absolute commitment, consciously adopted stand. So when we're thinking of His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Martin Luther King and their perspective on these verses, one thing that's extraordinary about them that we can see is both had a vision of what Martin Luther King used to call beloved community. So there's a sense of loving everyone in the community. And just as the prayer that we begin every Dri Kung meditation of may all sentient beings, including all those who harm me and hurt me, all, including all my enemies, there's a sense of the kind of love that sees the inner goodness in each being and sees the confusion of beings as they're acting and sees each person's need for love and acceptance even when they're behaving in terrible ways. When we look at what both of these men have been able to accomplish by maintaining this consciously adopted stand, this resolute response, this absolute commitment to love, we see that their lives then had the effect to change not only their neighborhood, not only their church, not only their community, but the whole world. That it was a global response to seeing the commitment to love enabled them to withstand whatever life presents. So His Holiness the Dalai Lama wasn't just working for the Tibetans. He's working for peace everywhere. Martin Luther King wasn't just working for his communities of African Americans. He was working for all beings everywhere. He was having a global effect, and of course we now know he will have an effect for lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes. So the framework of the verses as they evolve in this teaching, since enlightenment and the skillful means to benefit everyone has been established as the goal, then we work first on tolerance based on conscious acceptance of pain and hardship. Tolerance resulting from reflecting on the nature of reality and tolerance towards injuries from others. And I'm going to read from Martin Luther King, and he is defining love using the word agape, which is a particular kind of what he calls disinterested love, or the love for all beings, not only for your friends. In the final analysis, agape means recognition of the fact that all of life is interrelated. All humanity is involved in a single process, and all men are brothers. To the degree that I harm my brother, no matter what he is doing to me, to that extent I am harming myself. For example, white men often refuse federal aid to education in order to avoid giving the Negro his rights. But because all men are brothers, they cannot deny Negro children without harming their own. They end all efforts to the contrary by hurting themselves. Why is that? Because all men are brothers. If you harm me, you harm yourself. If I harm you, I harm myself. If you harm me, you harm yourself. So, starting with verse 1 in the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, good works are gathered in a thousand ages, such as deeds of generosity or offerings to the blissful ones. A single flash of anger shatters them. No evil is similar to anger, hatred, no austerity to be compared with patience. Steep yourself, therefore, in patience, in all ways, urgently, with zeal. And I'm sure everyone has had this experience, whether with a family member, with a loved one, with an animal, everyone who's parents, you have people you deeply care about and love, and one day you lose your temper and you can just see their face just change in the moment. And you know it is going to take months and months, if not years, to have what you had with them 1 second before. Right? We've all experienced that. Immediately, we can see that everything we care about like that has changed with a flash of anger or hatred. So the Dalai Lama continues to say why anger is the worst evil from his perspective, or the most difficult of all of the painful emotions, because it makes the best part of our brain, that which can judge right from wrong and assess short and long-term consequences, inoperable. We're in that rage of the moment, and our ability to judge evaporates. And then Martin Luther King, world peace through nonviolent means is neither absurd nor unattainable. All other methods have failed. Thus, we must begin anew. Nonviolence is a good starting point. Those of us who believe in this method can be voices of reason, sanity, and understanding amid the voices of violence, hatred, and emotion. We can very well set a mood of peace out of which a system of peace can be built. If we are caught up in the motions, we cannot be that voice of reason, sanity, and understanding. So by maintaining our consciousness, our equanimity, we can see what needs to be done and start to build the systems that are needed in families, in communities, and in the world. Then again, looking at things from the perspective of our wise selfishness, looking how it disturbs our mind greatly. So verse number 3. Those tormented by the pain of anger will never know tranquility of mind. Strangers they will be to every pleasure. Sleep departs them. They never can rest. If you're upset, the day can be beautiful. You can be walking in the country and your mind can be yammering, yammering, yammering. He did that to me. They were wrong. I was right. You can be at a feast. You can be at a party. Or We know that. We've experienced that, right? We're really so funny. So you know, it's so familiar, isn't it? Yeah. verse number 7, getting what I do not want and all that hinders my desire. There my mind finds fuel for misery. Anger springs from it, oppressing me. So it's the simplest beginning, the simplest spark, getting what you don't want and everything that hinders your desire. And one of the traditional Tibetan commentaries built that simple verse into 72 kinds of patience that are needed. So getting what you do not want, or someone in your family getting what they don't want, or your enemies getting what you want, he could take those verses and just see if you really look at that and think about that in terms of when we were discussing last week the worldly concerns like a good reputation, fame, all those things. Everything stems from those getting what you don't want and wanting what you're not able to get. Anger springs from it, oppressing me. So again, the sense of your anger that you create in your mind is your torture. 8, then the resolve, therefore I will utterly destroy the sustenance of this my enemy. If anger could be fueled by the food of your unhappiness, you're going to destroy the sustenance, my foe whose sole intention to bring me injury and sorrow. The foe, or the anger, whose sole intention is actually to bring oneself injury and sorrow. So we're going to destroy all the roots, all the food that causes the anger to become a forest fire. And then from Martin Luther King, hate destroys the personality of the hater. We usually think of what hate does for the individual hated, or the individuals hated, or the groups hated. But it is even more tragic, it is even more ruinous and injurious to the individual who hates. You just begin hating somebody and you will begin to do irrational things. You can't see straight when you hate. You can't walk straight when you hate. You can't stand upright. Your vision is distorted. There is nothing more tragic than to see an individual whose heart is filled with hate. He comes to the point that he becomes a pathological case. For the person who hates, you can stand up and see a person, and that person can be beautiful, and you will call them ugly. For the person who hates, the beautiful becomes ugly, and the ugly becomes beautiful. For the person who hates, the good becomes bad, and the bad becomes good. For the person who hates, the true becomes false, and the false becomes true. That's what hate does. You can't see right. The symbol of objectivity is lost. Hate destroys the very structure of the personality of the hater. Isn't that heartfelt and such a compassionate view when we think that it was written in the mid-50s, early 60s, at the time when people were so horribly treated, when his loved ones, his entire family, his loved ones were being treated terribly. He could still find that compassion to see the terrible injury that hatred did to the oppressor. So we're at verse 10 now. So now Shantideva is going to just calm everything down and say, okay, let's look at things. If there's a remedy when trouble strikes, what reason is there for despondency? And if there's no help for it, what is the use of being sad? So we get news out of the blue. If there's something we can do about it, we just start acting. If there's nothing we can do about it, what is the use of being angry? Because it just increases confusion, our confusion, and the confusion of those around it. So we see so often that we can joyfully work for change in the world. And we can see many times that when we're confused, simple things simply make us angrier. And that anger actually prevents us from taking very skillful steps that could actually affect the situation. So we're saying, what is the use in that moment? Verse 11, pain, humiliation, insults, or rebukes We don't want them either for ourselves or others, or for those we love. You know, we're incensed if someone says our mother, our father, our best friend, our child is terrible. It's even made a small mistake, we can get offended. However, if there's a pain, humiliation, insult, or rebuke for someone we don't like, it's just the opposite. It becomes a joke. You know, we can repeat it to others. We can practically start rejoicing that they're finally getting their due, as we might think. So it's not the insult, it's who's being insulted that's our problem. Right? So he's asking us, all right, let's just look at how our mind works. There's nothing inherently, our mind doesn't see something inherently wrong with insults. It's only when they're applied to us. Okay. So this is the kind of teasing he's going to be periodically, humorously injecting to lighten things up every once in a while. So then if we go to verse 14, and this is a very important verse, there is nothing that does not grow light through habit and familiarity. Putting up with little cares, I'll train myself to bear great adversity. So we know that changing the world, changing our hearts, helping to change other folks' hearts is a huge endeavor, and there's going to be adversity along the way. So starting to work with the small things, we begin to create equanimity and an even temper, and we can gradually then work with larger and larger things. So it's both practical and inviting us to notice when a small thing triggers us and say intentionally, okay, this I can deal with. The traffic's bad. I'm a little late. This is a small thing. Let me pay attention to this, so then when a big thing comes along, I'm prepared. And then verses 15, and do I not already bear with common irritations? For instance, bites and stings of snakes and flies. We don't have so many snakes here, but we have lots of flies. Experiences of hunger and thirst and painful rashes on my skin. So there are lots of things that we're patient with all the time that we don't even notice. Suffering also has its worth. Through sorrow, pride is driven out, and pity felt for those who wander in samsara. Evil is avoided, goodness seems delightful. That's verse 21. So we're looking at how to train and prepare for great adversity, starting with the small things. And again, I want you to hear Martin Luther's King's words as though he's addressing the folks who are going to go on the march tomorrow, knowing that there will be great adversity. Conditions are such for Negroes in America that all Negroes ought to be fighting aggressively. It is as ridiculous for a Negro to raise the question of self-defense in relation to nonviolence as it is for a soldier on the battlefield to say he is not going to take any risks. He is there because he believes that the freedom of his country is worth the risk of his life. The same is true of the nonviolent demonstrator. He sees the misery of his people so clearly that he volunteers to suffer in their behalf and put an end to their plight. He sees the misery of his people so clearly that he volunteers to suffer in their behalf and put an end to their plight. So that is pure bodhisattva aspiration. Seeing the confusion in oneself and others, devoting oneself to clearing one's heart and mind, devoting oneself to seeing the nature of their mind, this is not an easy task. It is a resolve and a commitment, seeing the misery, to go through whatever is necessary to be able to assist others. What is the nonviolent resistor's justification for this ordeal to which he invites men, for this mass political application of the ancient doctrine of turning the other cheek? The answer is found in the realization that unearned suffering is redemptive. Suffering, the nonviolent resistor realizes, has tremendous educational and transforming possibilities. Things of fundamental importance to people are not secured by reason alone, but have to be purchased with their suffering, said Gandhi. He continued, suffering is infinitely more powerful than the law of the jungle for converting the opponent and opening his ears, which are otherwise shut to the voice of reason. And then back to Shantideva, suffering also has its worth. Through sorrow, pride is driven out, and pity felt for those who wander in samsara. Evil is avoided, goodness seems delightful. So these are two different perspectives on the use of suffering. On the one hand, when we investigate suffering from the perspective of the Four Noble Truths and see how it is our confusion or our attachment or our wanting to avoid things that is the root of our own suffering, then we're able to start to see the shared human experience. And in seeing the shared human experience, we see that suffering has taught us to aspire to freedom from suffering, to learn the Dharma, and taught us to keep the aspiration and then develop the skillful means to help others out of the mire and confusion that we are all in. And from the perspective of this quote in terms of nonviolence, seeing that the oppressor is not moved by reason alone, that it was the act of marching. And then those of us who are old enough to remember, you've probably seen film clip, then we would see the sheriff with the big barking German shepherds and the firemen with their hoses. And seeing the suffering motivated people to say, this has to end now. So it gives a nuanced understanding to how we think of suffering and how we can use the human condition to open our hearts from moment to moment, both observing the suffering of others and seeing the torment we cause ourselves and wishing to remove that torment. So now I want to move to verses 39 to 45 or so, and this is the section of extraordinary logic that Shantideva uses. We're thinking that we understand now that anger is born in our mind due to conditions, and we're looking at how do we reframe our thinking to ameliorate our reactivity and to examine how we have thought of or remember the deep hurts that bind us to an angry mind. And what can be shocking about these series of verses is it starts from the wound out, not who did what to whom, but let's start with the intimacy of violence and move outwards. So he prepares us in verse 39 for taking this perspective. And he's helping us understand that people who are angry actually have no freedom. You know, we were talking about how hatred blinds the hater. And we're talking about the human condition that we recognize we are not exempt from, that it's shared, that we all have the same emotions. So in verse 39, if those who are like wanton children are by their nature prone to injure others, what point is there in being angry, like resenting fire for its heat? If all of us in samsara, other than the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, are confused, and we know the times that we've been blinded by our own confusion, and we know it's the nature of samsara that all beings are confused, how can we be angry at confused people? It's like being angry at fire for being hot. That is the nature of being alive in samsara. Just like, you know, if a small child hits you in the face, you know it's their nature not to understand that, so it doesn't disturb you at all. And this is taking it a stage further to begin to understand the human condition. And then verse 40, and if their faults are fleeting and contingent, that means contingent on conditions, if living beings are by nature wholesome, it's likewise senseless to resent them as well as be angry at the sky for having clouds. This is a particularly important verse because it's covering several topics. So the faults are contingent. If something always triggers you, that means you're walking around most of the day and you're fine. Then all of a sudden that thing that triggers you every time is in your face and you get angry. So it's a condition. You're not wandering around in anger every single second. It's the moment that that trigger arises that you respond, right? And that's true for everybody. And you and all beings are by nature a perfect Buddha. You have thoughts, the dualistic understanding of samsara, you have emotions, you have millions of things that are covering up that perfect Buddha nature. And sometimes it can feel like cement. But our nature, our actual nature, is perfection. So why are we angry? Would we be angry at the sky because there are clouds in the sky? The clouds are what cover the sky. Do we need to be angry at the sky when there are clouds? He's just asking you to think. And you can see this in your loved ones. You know, when you're pretty open to when they're angry, realizing that that's a mood they're in and letting go more quickly, right? Your loved ones, you believe in their essential goodness. So the incredible thing about this and the profound teaching about this is when you have a serious, serious, terrible event. And this is something that I'm looking at from my experience when my brother was murdered. There was the murderer. There is Holiness and Venerable Dahani. Holiness and Venerable Dahani, I can see their perfect Buddha nature, right? And they're saying the premise is that every being alive has this perfection. If it exists in me, it exists in you. If it exists in you, it exists in the murderer. You can't exclude one being and say that everyone else. So this is the part that started to save my sanity, to see that if it's true in them, these people I love, and I can see the development of the lessening of my emotions in studying the Dharma, then I have to be able to see in the most difficult time that there is a seed of goodness in the enemy. And then Martin Luther King. So somehow the isness of our present nature is out of harmony with the eternal oughtness that forever confronts us. And this simply means this, that within the best of us, there is some evil, and within the worst of us, there is some good. When we come to see this, we take a different attitude towards individuals. The person who hates you the most has some good in him. Even the nation that hates you most has some good in it. Even the race that hates you the most has some good in it. And when you come to the point that you look in the face of every man and see deep down within him what religion calls the image of God, you begin to love him in spite of. No matter what he does, you can see God's image there. There is an element of goodness that he can never slough off. Discover this element of good in your enemy. And as you seek to hate him, find the center of goodness and place your attention there, and you will take a new attitude. It is not only necessary to know how to go about loving your enemies, but also to go down into the question of why we should love our enemies. And I think the first reason that we should love our enemies was at the very center of Jesus' thinking, that hate for hate only intensifies the existence of hate and evil in the universe. If I hit you and you hit me and I hit you back and you hit me back and so on, you see that goes on ad infinitum. It just never ends. Somewhere somebody must have a little sense, and that's the strong person. The strong person is the person who can cut off the chain of hate, the chain of evil. And that is the tragedy of hate, that it doesn't cut it off. It only intensifies the existence of hate and evil in the universe. Somebody must have religion enough and morality enough to cut it off and inject within the very structure of the universe that strong and powerful element of love. Can't you imagine what a great time Martin Luther King and His Holiness the Dalai Lama would have? Can't you just see a joint teaching on Shantideva? It would just be moving. Now we're getting to the nitty-gritty of the reframing. And this is the part that takes a lot of going over many, many times for lots and lots of folks. So we're at verse 41. In this situation, somebody's hitting you. You can think of like with a baseball bat. Although it is I indeed, the stick that hurts me, I am angry at the one who wields it, striking me. But he is driven, impelled by anger. So it is his wrath I should resent. You're being hit. The stick is hitting you, and immediately you're angry with the person wielding the stick. But we just established there's a seed of goodness in that person, and they are clouded and out of control. So it is his wrath I should resent. It's the hatred I should resent, the anger I should resent. Disregarding the principle of cause, such as a stick and the like, if I become angry with the one who impels it, it is better if I hate hatred because that person is also impelled by hatred. That's another translation of the same verse. Okay, I'm going to skip to verse 43. Their weapons and my body, both are causes of my suffering. They their weapons drew while I held out my body. Who then is more worthy of my anger? This human form is like a running sore. Merely touched, it cannot stand the pain. I'm the one that clings to it with attachment. Whom should I resent when pain occurs? Okay, so we're deconstructing the whole event. Someone hits you with a stick. But what is happening? At that moment, your body hurts. So he's saying, okay, let's look at that. You're so happy to have a body. Are you angry with your body because it's the body that's actually causing you the pain right now? The stick is gone. You know, sometimes if somebody jokingly pokes you, it hurts. So it's actually the body that's causing the pain. Are you angry at the body? And it's actually the stick that hit the body, right? Are you angry with the stick? Why is it that we immediately jump to the person? Let's examine that. So in between was something unique to Buddhism, verse 42, that addresses the issue of karma. It was I in the past did harms to beings such as these, and so when others do me mischief, it is only just that they should injure me. So we don't want to have a simplistic understanding of this. There's the sense that in our lives, we have many karmic seeds that are ripening from lifetime after lifetime. It's not something that we did yesterday, and it's not something that we want to be feeling guilty about. We're not blaming the victim. We're just saying as a natural course of living, like you can imagine as a child running through the fields, all the bugs you stepped on. You know, there were just thoughtlessly, childishly, over lifetime after lifetime, we have caused pain. So in our life, that seed is now being repaired, coming to fruition, and something happens to us. So we want to look at this as a way of saying, now I'm going to guard my actions so carefully that I don't cause any karma by injuring others. Seeing that this sickness in my life, seeing that this is appearing or that is appearing, I know that there were causes and conditions from many different sides, many different contributing causes to this. One of the contributing causes is that I have a body at all. So we're looking at that. Now, continuing this in a very interesting way, those who harm me, I'm at verse 47, come against me summoned by my own karma, but they will be the ones who go to hell, and so it is myself who bring their ruin. So you're reversing things. For whatever reason, you're there, and in this moment, your karma is ripening. But when they are hitting you, they are creating new karma, and this karma is going to fruition in their future life. So in some ways, you can start to think about it as they're in deep trouble now. And you're free because your karma has ripened. So who is in the worst situation? They're in the worst situation. Then 48, because of them and through the exercise of patience, my many sins are cleansed and purified. But they will be the ones, thanks to me, who will have the long, drawn-out agonies of hell. So by maintaining equanimity, maintaining patience, by not responding in a reactive way, you're creating virtue. You're becoming closer to Buddhahood. You're blossoming. And at the same time, they're sinking deeper and deeper. 49. Therefore, I am their tormentor. Therefore, it is they who bring me benefit. Thus, with what perversity, pernicious mind, will you be angry with your enemies? They're helping you become a Buddha. They're sinking deeper. Why are we angry at them? It's a really incredible reversal of our normal reactive state. And then you can go back to Martin Luther King with an understanding of his perspective of seeing how tormented the hater is. If I repay them harm for harm, indeed they'll not be saved thereby. We're certainly not helping them. And if all my noble actions will be spoiled, austerity of patience brought to nothing. So if we do react, then on top of being hurt, we're hurting ourselves more, and we're not helping them anyway. So neither of us is closer to an open, loving heart. Okay, now here is Martin Luther King. Another way you love your enemy is this. When the opportunity presents itself for you to defeat your enemy, that is the time which you must not do it. There will come a time in many instances when the person who hates you most, the person who has misused you most, the person who has gossiped about you most, the person who has spread false rumors about you most, there will come a time when you will have an opportunity to defeat that person. It might be in terms of a recommendation for a job. It might be in terms of helping that person to make some move in life. That's the time you must not do it. That is the meaning in love. In the final analysis, love is not this sentimental something that we talk about. It is not merely an emotional something. Love is creative, understanding goodwill for all men. It is the refusal to defeat any individual. When you rise to the level of love of its great beauty and power, you seek only to defeat evil systems. Individuals who happen to be caught up in that system you love, but you seek to defeat the system. So your enemy needs a recommendation. Your enemy needs a job. That's the time you do it. You don't jump and say, ah. You don't defeat anyone. You defeat the hatred. You defeat the system. And then he goes on, because if you hate your enemies, you have no way to redeem and transform your enemies. But if you love your enemies, you will discover at the very root of love is the power of redemption. You just keep loving people and keep loving them even though they're mistreating you. Here's the person who is a neighbor, and this person is doing something wrong to you and all of that. Just keep being friendly to that person. Keep loving them. Don't do anything to embarrass them. Just keep loving them. And if they can't stand it, and they can't stand it too long. Oh, they react in many ways in the beginning. They react with bitterness because they're mad because you love them like that. They react with guilt feelings, and sometimes they'll hate you a little more at that transition period. But just keep loving them. And by the power of your love, they will break down under the load. There's something about love that builds up and is creative. There is something about hate that tears down and is destructive. So love your enemies. And then there's a really incredible insight. Another basic point about agape is that it springs from the need of the other person. It springs from the need of the enemy, he's saying. His need for belonging to the best of the human family. Since the white man's personality is greatly distorted by segregation and his soul is greatly scarred, he needs the love of the Negro, The Negro must love the white man because the white man needs his love to remove his tensions, insecurities, and fears. Therefore, if I respond to hate with a reciprocal hate, I do nothing but intensify the cleavage and broken community. I can only close the gap in broken community by meeting hate with love. If I meet hate with hate, I become depersonalized because creation is so designed that my personality can only be fulfilled in the context of community. Exquisite, exquisite. So again, Shanti Deva is now going to gently tease us. Let's look at our favorite ways of getting annoyed. our favorite triggers in life. 52, scorn and hostile words and comments that I do not like to hear. My body's not harmed by them. What reason do you have, O mind, for your resentment? It's not causing really any pain. So why mind, is it so difficult? Or greed, verse 60. Perhaps we claim that by our wealth we'll live, and living gather merit. But if we're ruthless for the sake of gain, its evil will gather, dissipating merit. Slander, 62. If when others slander us, we claim our anger is because they harm themselves. Okay, we could use some of these teachings as a weapon, also not good. How is it we do not resent their slander when it's aimed at another? Yeah, so he's got us. Even those who vilify and undermine the sacred doctrine, images, and stupas are not objects of our anger. The Buddhas are themselves untouched thereby. So if Buddhahood is a realization, that realization is perfectly at peace, no thought of self and other. So somebody hitting a statue with a hammer, ripping a tanka, is not a cause for anger from the Buddha's perspective. Then verse 67. Some do evil things because of ignorance. Some respond in anger being ignorant. Which of them is faultless in his acts? To whom shall error be attributed? So all the arguments when we think that we're innocent and someone else is to blame, and why isn't my parent, my teacher fixing things, my spouse, my team, whatever. You know, you go to a lama if you're upset about something and they only address the problem you have in your mind. And it can be very, very annoying because you're right. The problem should be fixed. The problem is, unfortunately, one's own mind. To whom shall error be attributed? Right? Your error is just as great. Verse 70. And now he's getting to the heart of things. For when a building is ablaze and flames leap out from house to house, the wise course is to take and fling away the straw and anything that spreads the fire. In fear that merit might all be consumed, we should at once cast far away our mind's attachment, tinder for the fiery flames of hate. So we look to see what is the root of all the different kinds of triggers, what are our attachments, and work with that, so that when the trigger arrives again, we don't have all of these lovely pieces of kindling that'll immediately heat the whole house. Jealousy. Verse 76. When others take delight in giving praise to those endowed with talents, why, O mind, do you not find a joy in likewise praising them? And then 79. When praise is heaped upon your merits, you're keen that others should rejoice in them. But when the compliment is paid to others, your joy is oh so slow and grudging. I love his sense of humor. 93. Children cannot help crying when their sandcastles come tumbling down. Our minds are so like them when praise and reputation start to fail. 99. Those who stay close to me, then to ruin my good name and cut me down to size, are surely there protecting me from falling into ruin in the realms of sorrow. So in case you were getting big-headed, you have people close to you who are reminding you of your faults. And everybody loves Atisha's story. When he was traveling to Tibet, he was going to move to Tibet to teach. And he had heard that everybody there was wonderful. And he thought, oh, what am I going to do? I'll have no way to learn patience. And he took his most aggravating, annoying servant with him. So there wouldn't be any danger of him not having many daily lessons. I remember once, I did something terribly incompetent, and I said to Venerable, who was, of course, very patient, I said, well, you know, I've heard that it's good to have not so great attendance. It's considered a virtue of the Lama to take on or to train people. Verse 100, for I am one who strives for freedom. I must not be caught by wealth and honors. How could I be angry with the ones who work to loosen me from my fetters? These people are helping me. If I fail to practice patience, hindered by my own deficiency, I am myself the obstacle to gaining merit, yet so close at hand. Okay, then the final series of his logic that is tremendously helpful when you can contemplate it over time and apply it. 107. So like a treasure found at home, enriching me without fatigue, all enemies are helpers in my bodhisattva work, and therefore should be a joy to me. But this enemy conspired to harm me, I protest, and therefore should receive no honors. But had he worked to help me like a doctor, how could I have brought forth patience? So we don't want to give credit to our enemies for being our greatest teachers. But like a doctor, they have brought forth the patience. We can't learn patience without being in community with someone who triggers us. Really and truly, I've read several times that the great lamas, who rarely get angry, find it so helpful to work in many ways with the emotion and see the purity of hatred or the wisdom inherent of hatred, that when someone makes them angry, they get all excited, they run in the room, they close the door, and they sit down to meditate. So they can use this emotion arising once again because it doesn't happen very often anymore. And they can in the instant see the inherent wisdom in that emotion. Okay, then this is the key verse. Thus the state of Buddhahood depends on beings and the Buddhas equally. By what tradition is it then that Buddhas but not beings are revered? We have all these teachings from the Buddha, all these teachings in the Christian tradition and in every tradition to love your enemies. We see that our wisdom is an evolution or a blossoming of the situations of life, so it's dependent on the teachings we're receiving and the enemies in the situation. Why is it that we revere the Buddhas and not the actual in-the-moment cause of our wisdom ripening? How could we be so crazy not to see? And even if that king were pleased, even if a king could give you enlightenment, for this will only be achieved by bringing happiness to living beings. The Buddha can't give us enlightenment. Our favorite, most inspirational person cannot give us enlightenment. It's only achieved by bringing happiness to living beings and bringing happiness to all living beings, which includes our enemies, our greatest teachers. So I want to conclude with two more quotes from Martin Luther King. I must continue by faith, or it is too great a burden to bear, and violence, even in self-defense, creates more problems than it solves. Only a refusal to hate or kill can put an end to the chain of violence in the world and lead us towards a community where men can live together without fear. Our goal is to create a beloved community, and this will require a qualitative change in our souls as well as a quantitative change in our lives. And honestly, if you've been with the Dalai Lama when he's teaching, this is where he breaks down and cries. And he says, I cannot prove to you that changing how we act and respond and reframe is going to change us. But we have to see that our reactivity as a person, as a community, as a nation, has only caused more violence. So that's why this significant reframing from how it harms us to the enemy being clouded and crazed and harming themselves, and looking at the problem, dissecting the problem and really analyzing, is it necessary to hate in this situation, to then seeing how the actual changes in our lives have come about from these difficult situations, and the enemies have truly been our teachers, is what leads to change at a small scale and a large scale. So then he says, so this morning, as I look in your eyes and into the eyes of all my brothers in Alabama and all over America and over the world, I say to you, I love you. I would rather die than hate you. And I'm foolish enough to believe that through the power of this love, somewhere men of the most recalcitrant bent will be transformed. And then we will be in God's kingdom. We will be able to matriculate into the university of eternal life because we had the power to love our enemies, to bless those persons that cursed us, to even decide to be good to those persons who hated us, and we even prayed for those persons who despitefully used us. I say to you, I love you. I would rather die than hate you. And whether we call it God's kingdom or enlightenment, that's how we matriculate into that university. Okay, so now we have time for questions. I'm going to repeat for the people who are on the phone. So she was saying she was in the Far East, and at that time she was a Christian. So Audrey was saying she was in a situation where someone was unjustly accused of stealing, and Audrey witnessed that someone else had taken it. The thief stayed in the crowd, and the person who lost the object accused, a white person accused of a black person, and shouted at them and said, I'm white and you're black, so I'm right. You did it. So she could see that a mob was starting, and that he had hit the man he was accusing. The person who, the racist person, wanted to deny that he did anything. And so she said, you have to stop this. You're developing a crowd, and it's actually you who are in the wrong. So a lady standing in the crowd said to Audrey, well, why don't you hit that guy then? And Audrey stopped and thought and said, now, doesn't that make the whole situation worse? So the racist guy said, well, why should you hit me? And Audrey said, you've got the answer right there. So things are progressing with the Audrey and the bad guy. The guy who's starting the angry mob says to Audrey, well, haven't you ever hit anybody? And Audrey says, well, you know, yes, I have. And he said, well, who did you hit? And she said, well, there was a man who was hitting an older woman and beating her, and she told him to stop, and he said, why should I stop? And she said, or why is it your business? And she said, well, because I'm a woman, and you're hitting a woman. Because he was an angry person, she asked him, why were you angry? And he said, because she crossed in front of me. We all want Audrey in the street with us. She's really doing an incredible intervention. And what the poor man didn't realize is Audrey is psychic, and she could see incidents in his life where he had pushed people out of the way and could bring to his mind how he didn't want to be hit because he had pushed people out of the way. And she invited him to be more hesitant before he reacted. And so she encouraged him to contemplate the teachings of whatever religion he ascribed to help him with his anger. Okay, so we have a question here. Hello? Question on the phone?
Hi, Kenmo?
Yeah, hi.
Hey, it's Roz.
Hey, hi, Roz.
My question is something you addressed earlier in the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Talked about how when you were in the presence of something or someone who would cause great negative karma, mm-hmm. that you should remove yourself and remove others from that situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard a story that when the Dalai Lama was in Vancouver.
So we're talking about removing self or others from harm, and she's talking about the Dalai Lama in Vancouver. Okay.
So in the interview, the question that was asked of him was, if you were sitting beside Hitler, what would the best thing to do be?
Mm-hmm.
And there, because he always has an entourage, there was great discussion
mm-hmm.
amongst the entourage.
Mm-hmm.
And what I what the answer was that you should kill Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes against all of the teachings of one doesn't kill, but your explanation of you should remove others and yourself from a situation where there will be karma caused. What I understand that story as.
She was talking about if you were sitting beside Hitler, should you kill Hitler? And the Dalai Lama's answer was yes. And, of course, we all have the vow not to kill. So when I was talking about what a bodhisattva does, it's, first of all, if you have the skill to work with the circumstances, work with the circumstance. If you don't have the skill, then you remove yourself and others. So someone, and it's quite unique to Mahayana Buddhism, we have the sense that an extraordinarily evolved person can make a particular kind of judgment. So if they see that a being in their whole life will only do evil and will never have the opportunity to ever change or ever do anything good, and it will only bring negative consequences for many, many people, if they have that kind of ability, and if they can, without a shred of anger in their hearts, then kill someone, then, yes, they will have karmic consequences, but it will only be minute because their intention is so beneficial. Someone who was enraged, someone who was doing it with a sense of revenge, would be harming themselves in a vastly different kind of way. So we're looking at particular kinds of skills. And then at an even higher level, when we ask then, that might be a bodhisattva, what could a fully realized person do? A fully realized person essentially liberates the so-called evildoer into the nature of their mind. They don't actually kill them, so they wouldn't be breaking any vow. So, for instance, we see Tilopa sitting on the banks, and he's eating fish, and then as he tosses the skeleton into the water, the fish become alive again. There's that illusory sense and understanding of the nature of reality. So yes, there are levels of skill and levels of understanding and levels of appropriate action. Do you hear what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I guess I have a further question, though,
mm-hmm.
which is, say you weren't fully realized and say you did choose to kill Hitler because you recognized he was going to do imminent, immense harm, and you did kill him and you did have anger because we're not fully realized,
mm-hmm.
would there be a mitigation of the act because still the intention was to save other beings?
Yes, of course.
But you wouldn't have the ultimate ability to, as I understood you to say, that...
Yeah.
The enlightened person could actually liberate the soul and have it reborn into a higher karmic state, whereas the ordinary person wouldn't be able to do that. particularly yes. because they wouldn't have in their heart the ability to love the person as Vajra Yogini, destroying something to make room for ultimate, for future, immensely beautiful possibilities.
Right. The caution is, when we're moved by hatred and anger, and when we have less ability, is in the moment. And that's why sort of imagining situations like this aren't as useful, really, as using Shanti Deva's teachings to work on a wound in one's own life, because they're so hypothetical. So we never say never. We never say you shouldn't act in a difficult situation. But the caution I found tremendously interesting when we think of someone who ostensibly didn't have any redeeming actions is you wouldn't want to take the precious human life away from someone if there was a chance that they could have a realization or understanding of the harm they've caused and change. And that's why it's the bodhisattva that we say, yes, at that skill level, you can be confident. But you're right, and the consequences when you're motivated by love, not hatred, are certainly much less. But the teachings of patience, you know, are useful as a tool when applied to oneself. Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah, and what has come to me as we've talked about this,
mm-hmm.
that the danger of not being totally enlightened and taking someone's life is that it just perpetuates the anger retribution cycle.
Yes.
Because it's so easily misunderstood.
Inevitably, we go to, well, what if it was the most evil person in the world? Do they still have Buddha nature? They do have Buddha nature. If Holiness the Dalai Lama has Buddha nature, then the most evil person in the world has Buddha nature. Are you justified in killing? And Roz is just saying that she understands that the cycle of retribution takes over in so many cases. So we look at our national circumstances right now, and we think from our side, Osama bin Laden was the most evil person, you know, for a generation of people. Did the killing of him have equally far-reaching consequences of millions of people now feeling like someone they loved was unjustifiably killed and wanting revenge? It does keep all of these cycles going. So that's why, although one doesn't say never, one says really let's look at the wisdom and look at what wisdom actually means in that situation. In terms of can this heal some of the things that are most deeply troubling in our hearts, if you take some of Shanti Deva's verses and just take one verse and look at it for some time and then say, now how might this help? Can I look at it from this way? Does it make sense? Does it ease my heart to look at it from this way? Can I start to heal the anger that I carry if I look at things from a different perspective? Okay, another question.
Thank you so much for sharing the Dharma with us today and your insight and open-endedly sharing. I just have a quick question. Early on in your talk, you mentioned there was a Tibetan text about the 72 types of patience that can be developed, mm-hmm. and I was wondering if there is a general name given to that text.
Oh, it was part of the commentary. I think it's called Manjushri's Speech, and it's a commentary, a line-by-line commentary on the Bodhisattva's way of life.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I have plenty of questions, but that's all I'll ask for now. Thank you.
Well, the Tibetans are so great at classifying things. So it was, here, let me see. I'll give you the basics of it. They divided the patients. First, there are 12 kinds of things that we don't want for ourselves and our loved ones. So that means 6 that we don't want for ourselves, and then the same 6 applied to our loved ones, and 12 things that hinder our desires, 6 for us and 6 for our loved ones. And there were things like we don't want suffering, We don't want direct verbal aggression. We don't want destruction of reputation by malicious rumors or disadvantages resulting from contemptuous discrimination. And then the things that hinder our desires seem to be the opposite of those things. And they kept classifying them for ourselves and our loved ones and our enemies until it got to 72. It was such a joy to steep myself in Martin Luther King for today. It's presented from the perspective of the Tibetan history and the Tibetan stories, and I really loved just going a little more deeply into Martin Luther King. I read his biography periodically, and it always brings inspiration. And more questions?
Hi there. My name is Jenny, and I'm a guest of Kathy's, and I have a question. Thank you first for the talk. I've been really deeply inspired, and I'm thinking about my own reactivity, and it often shows up in being frozen.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering about frozenness as it relates to reactivity and how, and I guess its relationship to whether karma, the karma of those by whom I feel attacked, if I'm somehow, like, how does that relate to karma ripening? Because it can look like equanimity, but it's not.
Yes, and we know that it's not. That's a response I often have. She's talking about what is when your reactivity results in a frozenness. From my experience, it's a kind of shock. So I would agree with you. That's not, in my case, certainly it's not equanimity. And so you can go back to the verses and just replace things with frozenness or shock in terms of the word to help you. But one verse is, why are we disturbed by the warring wants of childish like minds, if that's their nature? That's not an exact quotation, but one thing that's helpful is, you know, we're continually shocked by some of these behaviors, and so we freeze. And then why is that so shocking to us if that is the nature of the human condition? So I would say you're correct, and it's good in the sense because you're not causing new karma by screaming at the person, right? At least if you're shocked, you're silent. So helping yourself to look at it and see what is the wise course of action you need to take. Because as I was saying, that patience earlier is clearly not a victimhood or a fearful response that prevents you from acting. So using the moments as you were not acting to then examine what the wise course would be. What do you need to learn about yourself? Why this is so hurtful to you? What do you need to know about the situation? What can you do in the situation? And I find Pema Chodron on anger is tremendous. So if you, her book, Going to the Places That Scare Me, so she asks you to examine in the moment, what is it, not right or wrong, but what is it then the person can hear? What can they take in that would help look at the situation? And then in terms of, it's a kind of wisdom I think that comes with age when you start to see, oh my goodness, this is the third relationship with the same pattern. I'm clearly creating the same series of events in my life. What is it that I'm doing in this situation that's always creating the same cast of characters? What is it that I'm attached to that's magnetizing these cast of characters? What is it, like, is it a sense of pride that I'm always having someone near me that's denigrating me? You see what I mean? Try to see what is going on that causes the same situation to come about time after time. And this is actually a wonderful insight because, and I'm again remembering something from Pema Chodron on Going to the Places That Scare You. One of the extraordinary teachings is, like, for instance, if we're anger, if we have a trigger, it's like wearing a target on our back. Whenever that trigger comes up, the arrow hits the target. But if we take the target off our backs, there's nothing to hit. So that's how you see the part that's yours to take care of. Again, I say yes because I have worked with these things. so often. I promise you, they are tremendously helpful.
Thank you.
I really recommend reading this. And many people find that there's one verse that's hard for them, and they just work with that over and over and over again from lots of different perspectives. And when they get it, I promise you, that moment is tremendously freeing. I'd like to just reread the last quote from Martin Luther King again, because it was so lovely. "I must continue by faith, or it is too great a burden to bear, and violence, even in self-defense, creates more problems than it solves. Only a refusal to hate or kill can put an end to the chain of violence in the world and lead us toward a community where men can live together without fear. Our goal is to create a beloved community, and this will require a qualitative change in our souls, as well as a quantitative change in our lives. I say to you as I look in your eyes, I love you, I would rather die than hate you." So we'll finish in April with these talks, but we've completed Preventing Virtue from Declining. And the last four chapters are then on enthusiastic effort, meditative concentration, wisdom, and then dedication. So thank you, everybody.